So this is the fourth day of this four-day retreat. The mind trainings, the Lojong as it's called in Tibetan, that have come down to us from the Indian master Atisha. We received them from his teachers. I'm sure they received them from their teachers. And it's come down to us here in Tampa this week. Causes and conditions and impermanence. Have all of us in this room, simply causes and conditions that brought us to the Dharma path. It's just causes and conditions that brought us to the Florida Community of Mindfulness. It's causes and conditions that brought us to come to this retreat. And it is causes and conditions that will lead us to return to our non-retreat lives in just a few hours. Everything is impermanent. Coming down here just a few minutes ago, I walked through the halls. The halls are covered with dirty sheets outside every room. Impermanence. The beds that were slept in last night are empty, ready to receive new guests. This is not unusual. This is what's going on every day. Things are just unfolding. This world of impermanence according to causes and conditions. Hopefully, the ease of coming and the ease of staying and the ease of going is all easy. This is just the way it is. It is a fact of life. And we want to learn how to be in life with ease, with openness, with intelligence, compassion, understanding, kindness, open-heartedness, generosity, etc. So hopefully the same way that we move through the ease of the comings and goings of this retreat, we move through the comings and goings of our life. They are no different. Over these past 4 days, there has been much teachings, much practice. And everybody in here has gone through mind states, haven't you? You thought this, and you thought that. And this mind state arose, and that mind state arose. Sometimes your mind was clear, and sometimes your mind was unclear. Sometimes your mind was restful. Sometimes it was agitated. Sometimes you were happy, sometimes you were sad. Sometimes you thought, ooh, I'm doing well, and sometimes you thought, oh, you're doing terrible. Sometimes you were happy to be here, and sometimes you couldn't wait till it was over. Right? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And all of that, where is that all now? Gone. Not a trace. Just think, if you had known it then, would you have gotten hooked up into what you got hooked up into? Stuck in what you got stuck in? Fixated on what you were fixated? Made such a big deal about what you made such a big deal about? If you understood that one day you'd be sitting here and it would be all gone. Right? Doesn't matter in the slightest. You had a good retreat, you had a terrible retreat. Doesn't matter. You thought this, you thought that, you liked this, you didn't like that. You thought this was delicious, you thought this was terrible. Where is that all? Gone. Wisdom is understanding this not afterwards, but at the time. There are no points for being wise today about yesterday. Is that clear? Cultivating wisdom is you finally get it, and now you live it. So when it is arising, you understand that whatever is arising, good or bad, it's just arising and it will be passing. It is substanceless. Right? We had some experiences of spending time looking into this mind of ours and watching it. Looking into thoughts. Nothing of any solid, permanent self-existence is found at all. And even these karmic imprints that, you know, that we're so concerned about, when we look for them, we can't even find them. With true insight, it makes a deep imprint on the mind. It changes us. That's what we want. And said in the tradition, mindfulness, certainly wonderful, will not liberate us. You can be just very mindful of your delusions. A few points for that. You can be mindful of your ego. Get a few points for that. But that's not liberation. Liberation only comes from insight. The practice of compassion, loving kindness in the way that we were shown here in this text is one way to open that door to liberation. An essential way. So over these past 4 days, I just counted them up, we focused on 11 short sentences. That's what we did. 11 slogans. Most of them very short sentences. Why they're called pith teaching. They could be small, but they have a kernel of great insight and wisdom. Again, this is a wondrous text because so much, if not all, of the essential teachings and practices of the Bodhisattva Mahayana path are in this text. You're going to have a few companion texts with you on your journey in this life. This would be one of them. If you're going to use your mind for any benefit, memorize these slogans. So you can take them out as needed. So let us, we don't have much time this morning. It's an abbreviated morning. But I want to make sure that there is not perfect understanding and realization on all the points, but there's a basic understanding of what we've been up to. Again, as you've heard me say over and over again, first training the preliminaries, and they are essential. They come before They come before practice. They get us ready to practice. They prepare us to practice. Is that clear? And to be able to repeat them like a parrot is not to know them and to really see their profound and deep implications for our life, for the way we conduct our lives, not just overall, but every day. Again, I assure you that if you contemplate deeply and really are willing to look at the implications of what these preliminaries are telling us, not to say all, I won't say all, I'll say most of the dramas and the fixations and the obsessions and the ruminations and the melodramas and the emotionality that afflict you will no longer. This is even before you've learned anything about meditation. Your life will be significantly different just by the deep contemplation, reflection on these four reflections. There is a reason they have been preserved. They are the reason they are still taught. So again, first train in the preliminaries. Train. Training implies over and over training in them. Training what? Training to view reality as it really is. In our ignorance, we what? We see permanent solidness where there is impermanence and no solidity. Fundamental misperception. All day long we do it. Whether it's all the external things that appear to our five senses or the internal phenomena, thoughts, feelings, perceptions, memories that appear to our mind. All day long we perceive them as solid, permanent things. Fundamental misperception. Once we make that misperception, the drama of samsara will unfold. All day long, we do not see cause and effect. We see effect, we don't see cause. And because we do not see cause, and we only see effect, and we interpret it through our misperceptions, again, off we go. The whole world of misperception, emotional affliction that we create every day is because we don't understand causation. We understand effects, and we, you know, how did it happen? Right? That's ignorance. If you don't know causation, then we're ignorant. And yet that doesn't stop us. We still carry on. Blind to cause and effect, we just, you know, undertake relationships, open our mouths, spout out this and that. The blind leading the blind. Isn't that the truth? Please. Cause and effect. Understand what's unfolding here and why. The fundamental defects of samsara. What is occupying our minds day and night? The activities of the world, right? Why do we have our mood changes? So all we're thinking about is this world and how I can find safety, happiness, meaning in this world. Get more things, get more money, get more relationships, get a geographical cure. I mean, we are endlessly manipulating the world of phenomena and things because we believe no matter how much Dharma we've been exposed to, right, that happiness will be found here. Right? We just get it right. And then along comes this teaching that says, you'll never get it right. There's a fundamental flaw. There's a fundamental defect. Right? Why are you working so hard to get it right? It doesn't work out the way you want. That's the truth. And everybody in here knows that, right? Because it hasn't worked out the way you wanted your whole life. But that doesn't stop us, right? You will leave here and you'll continue on. Even though the teachings are very clear. Doesn't mean, again, you know, this is not like, you know, doesn't mean we can't find temporary moments of happiness and joy and pleasure. But that's only one side of this world. Isn't that clear? The other side is also here, and it's because of that. For those who really are looking for meaning and purpose and happiness and joy and peace of mind, etc., they know they will never find it as long as I'm looking to a field that is essentially fallow. It doesn't mean things don't grow there. They don't grow. You know, I realize this may sound heavy duty, but again, I'm not, this is not Fred speaking. I'm just a representative, a lowly representative of the noble Lord Buddha. He's the one who set down this edict. Just the guy carrying the message. Is that clear? It is the message of every master from beginningless time. Now, why did they say it? They're not in it for the money. You know, why did they say it to us? You have to stop and think, why did they say that? It is only because of their compassion. Because they see us suffering. They see us running around, wearing ourselves out, getting weary, getting brokenhearted, you know, getting stressed out. Right? Getting disappointed, getting hurt, getting angry, getting frustrated, getting depressed, getting anxious, right? They see us running around in life. They see what's going on, getting addicted. Right? I mean, you know, we don't even bat our eyes when we hear somebody's gone into rehab. It's like, oh, part of life. Right? This one's on that antidepressant, that's one's on that anti-anxiety, right? So you don't go, gee, maybe there's some fundamental defect in people, you know what I mean, that people need all this stuff to keep going, right? If you want to make some money, invest in the pharmaceutical industry. They understand what's going on. They figured out a way to make money on it. Right? But again, Buddhas and the Masters saw this thousands of years ago. And so they set forth these fundamental contemplations that help us see clearly, to save us more dissatisfaction, more frustration, more, you know, no matter what we're doing, even things are going well, deep down inside, there's something never quite right. For some, it just could be something a little nagging in the background. It's never totally satisfying. There's always something missing, even when things are good. These are deeply intimate. And then, of course, the fourth about the preciousness is to really understand the unique advantages of having a human birth as opposed to other forms of life. And then again, for those of us, et cetera, with the junctions and the freedoms, I won't go into that again, but they were illustrated in during the retreat, and you can continue to meditate on them. You know, how could, you know, we are so fortunate. Right? I mean, we're not walking through Europe getting away from war and ravage in the Middle East. You know? Right? Homeless and shelterless. People being so indifferent to us. Right? We are so fortunate, those of us sitting here. We are fortunate, I mean, that's just an extreme example, but I mean, we're just so fortunate because, you know, we have these teachings that tell us, explain what's going on and how to be happy and how to have a meaningful life, right? It's not as if we have to do anything grand, not as if we have to, you know, significantly make external changes. We just need to change our minds. When we change our minds, we can change the way we speak and the way we behave and the things we do with our body. And all of a sudden, you know, our life is no longer a source of suffering to ourselves and to other people, but our life is a source of goodness to ourselves and other people. We can be a refuge. We can be of help. We can be of true nurturance and support. We have to turn away from our, you know, elusive, endless running after that which is essentially meaningless. And we have to give up the self that is, you know, constantly egging us on. Right? We even come to a retreat, right? Oh, wonderful. Right? Good weather, good friends, good food. Decent beds, you know, right? Dharma, I mean, you know. And this self will complain in here, won't it? Right? How many people heard their complaining voice? Yeah, I mean, you know, there it is. You know. Me. What's wrong? I'm not getting my way. Point, we got to kind of get it. You know? So please first begin with the preliminaries. And then the second day, we spent a full day teachings and the practices relating to ultimate bodhicitta. And again, absolute bodhicitta. And again, as you probably have already put together, the teachings that we received here coming from Atisha, you know, coming from this tradition, is the same teaching about the nature of mind and nature of phenomena that you've chanted every morning in the Heart Sutra. It is the original teachings of the Buddha about the nature of phenomena, the nature of mind. Okay? So there it is, you know, classical Buddhist teaching in the Heart Sutra, Prajnaparamita Vidaya Sutra. You know, then you, you know, you flip a few pages, third Zen patriarch, right? Trust in mind. China, Zen, not India, not Tibet, same teaching. Right? Same teaching. So again, as it is said in the text, these are the most profound insights of Buddhism. But again, last night we did some practice. The night before we did some practice. Right? And hopefully many people at least got a little taste, a little glimpse of this absolute bodhicitta. This mind is more than a collection of thoughts. Is this unborn awareness can be noticed, that can be penetrated, and that can be rested in. And that one can make it the basis for one's life. And we are told after our meditations on Absolute Bodhicitta to now go into the world as a conjurer, knows that everything he perceives, everything he sees, smells, tastes, touch, feels, thinks, is just his own conjuring, her own conjuring. In the house of illusions, only the illusionist knows the truth. Everybody else is fool. Right? But the conjurer, the illusionist, knows what's up. In the teachings of Absolute Bodhicitta, you are given the key. I'm the illusionist. All thoughts, feelings, perceptions, all my conceptualizations, all the fabrications of my mind are the creations of my own mind. Right? They're not coming from anywhere else. They're my own creations. Now, the illusionist, the conjurer, is intelligent enough to know that. That which is his conjuring is just a show. It's to entertain. But it's not real. The conjurer knows it's not real. The illusionist knows it's not real. But we are like some kind of mythical creature that has kind of, you know, we're like in amnesia. And we look around at a room full of our own creations and we think they're real. Is that the truth? So, these teachings and most importantly the practices of Absolute Bodhicitta return us to sanity. Sanity. Is that clear? In the world of mental health, it is said there are some people who are sane, some people who are insane. Of course, a lot depends on, you know, which one you are, so you can call the others. But we won't go into that one. But generally, there is a sense that people who are sane are seeing reality without distortion, right? I mean, that's the hubris of the sane. Right? And somebody who is insane is what? Somebody who is insane is what? Not seeing reality. They're crazy. They don't see reality. They think the fabrications of their mind are real. We say, that person's crazy. They hear voices in their head and they think they're real. Anybody hear a voice in their head during this retreat? Did you think that voice was real? Yes. I mean, right? Some people might call that insane or crazy. We endlessly project, you know, out into the world on everyone we see, every situation, right? Judgments, evaluations, comparisons, I mean, interpretations, all that's called projections. Right? And we think they're real. Again, if a human being sees things that aren't there but thinks they're real, what do they call, Brandy? Or crazy, in the old way. Insane, we used to say. Now we're more or less sophisticated. Right? Remember, they used to call them insane asylums. right? And people were insane. I mean, there was some truth in that. I mean, not for the poor people, but I mean, just understanding, you know, that there is a sanity and there is an insanity. And people who are insane, who do not see reality, who think their own projections, their own voices are real and follow them around in every direction, these poor people need to be what? Gathered up, you know, and put into a safe environment where they cannot harm themselves or harm others. But we've escaped. Right? And Gary wonders why the world is the way it is. They've escaped, Gary. They're out there, they don't even see what they're doing. No, they're crazy. They're insane. They think this will go on forever. Just gobble, gobble, gobble. Eat up all the resources, you know. It'll all be fine. I mean, that's crazy. So again, unfortunately, you see, these teachings, I'm not saying Buddhism is the only place. Hopefully, there are many places in this world that have sanity. But this is sanity. Can you see it? This is sanity. This isn't Dharma. This is sanity. And the difference between, let's say, us and somebody who is insane, now I'm coming back to Sandy, is we have, see, when you're insane, in a certain sense, when you're in it, there's no hope because you actually are totally in it, right? You believe. See, we're fortunate, those of us in this room. We're crazy, but we kind of know we're crazy, right? You can see that's good. Right? You know, so we can kind of pull ourselves back. Right? There's enough. There's good karma. There's enough sanity in there. That even when we're crazy, even when we're running amok, creating suffering for ourselves and others, and you know, there's a voice inside us for some reason that goes, this is not working. This is crazy. Okay? And then we discover Dharma, let's say. And again, I'm not excluding other traditions, but this is just the one I know. There's this whole body, incredible body of teaching and philosophy and psychology, of, you know, practice. And, you know, that's all about sanity. It's sane. It just describes reality in a very astute, clear way. Is that clear? That's what this is. Don't make it into something religious, okay, or mystical, or esoteric. This is sanity. This is clear thinking. This is seeing things as they really are. This is health. Is that clear? That's all this is. But you have to be convinced of it over and over and over again. If you're just convinced of it while you're at retreat and you walk out of here and 2 days from now you're back in it, don't blame me. Don't blame the Buddha. Don't blame Atisha. Right? Is that clear? You want to be sane. If you want to really lead a good, purposeful life, here's the man. I don't get a cut if you buy it. No hidden agenda here. You know? Is that clear? But if you walk out this door, you know, and you jump right back into it, and don't blame your karma. Don't blame your heavy-duty karma. Because there's an opening now. And you can walk through it. Everybody in this room can walk through. The door is open. You decide, you know, just to kind of keep walking on. You know, return to the, you know, the doors you know, the paths you know well. You know, in Buddhism there is cause and effect, and there's also in Buddhism there is free will. It's very interesting. Cause and effects are conditioning this moment, but in this moment, if we are conscious and awake and mindful, we can do something different. Everybody in here can do something different. But you have to be awake, have to be conscious, you have to, you know, be clear about, you know, the direction you want to go in life. So you know what to say yes to and what to say no to. What to pick up and what to lay down. You don't know it, and then you will just continue on. Everybody in this room has a default, right? That if you're unconscious and unmindful and not clear and you're not practicing, it will take you over. There is no doubt that will happen. Everybody in this room, it will happen, because that's the pattern you've been working. That's what you know. And it's easy. You don't have to do anything, do you? It'll just unfold. Just the way it always has. It's so easy. So we can't be lazy. We're lazy. Our causes and effects that have driven us in the past will just continue to drive us. Understanding that, we understand that we have to do things differently. Make choices. Of what we say yes to, what we say no to, what the priorities are in our life, where we put our energy. So again, after looking at absolute bodhicitta, yesterday we looked at the teachings and practices, just really touching the surface of these teachings about relative bodhicitta, and we learned yesterday it goes beyond just compassion, kindness. It is about truly living a altruistic life that is more toward turned outward to benefiting others than always inward simply to benefit myself. It is a fundamental shift. It is not just becoming more compassionate, a little kinder. Many people think that's what it's about. It's not about that. That can just be another stance of self. Wasn't it George Bush or somebody? Isn't it like a kinder nation, kinder? What? Right, becoming but sort of a kinder, right. There you go. I won't say any more. It's not about that. Okay? It's about a fundamental, radical shift in view and intention. Becoming aware of motherly sentient beings. All of them. I remember years ago, you know, in the Zen tradition, they make the four vows, right? One of the vows is, I vow to liberate all sentient beings, right? Big, big vow. Or else you can say, you know, when I make my aspiration doing my compassion, right, we say what? Charlie says it. He says what? When you at the end of the night, you say what? May this practice benefit all beings. What? Of all beings. Shared equally for the benefit of all beings. And we feel good. Wow. What a wonderful altruistic person I am. I want to benefit everyone. Right? See, that's abstract. That's easy. That doesn't mean anything. See? Right? These are sentient beings. Everybody you encounter during the day, that's a sentient being. You see? So if you want to benefit all beings, you want to benefit everybody you encounter during the day. That's what it means. Right? To have some kind of abstract, intention to benefit all beings that doesn't see that we're talking about real people. It's kind of, developing a compassion that's sort of in its own realm. That is why in the Tonglen and the Metta, we actually visualize people. People we know. Oh, that person. But one I really don't like, one who gives me a hard time, one who disappointed me, or hurt me, or betrayed me, or did something to my child. Oh, that person. That's hard. I don't want to do that. I'd much rather do metta for everyone. Spread the light of loving kindness in every direction. How wonderful I am. And how wonderful the world is. That's kind of like a meta practice that they do at Disneyland. Right? And then everybody goes home, they take off their Mickey costumes. Everybody was in fantasy land all day, and they have to leave and get back in their cars. Kids are screaming, But for a few hours there, it was all kind of wonderful, wasn't it? Everything was just wonderful. I remember the first time I went to Disney with my kids, I thought, maybe we should turn the world over to these people. everything works, everybody's kind and nice and happy, Maybe we could sell the world to Disney. They could run it. Anyway. So our compassion, our loving kindness, our altruism, our generosity. Generosity. I'm sure someone's given a Donna talk. Generosity. If we are honest with ourselves, who are we most generous to in this life? Whose needs are we most focused on, being generous toward? Who? Me. If you like going out to eat and not cooking tonight, here, let me take you out. You deserve it. Right? You're sick of the old car, like a new car. You deserve it. Yeah. Tired of the old dishwasher. You deserve a new one. Yeah, right? I mean, think about it. We have no problem practicing generosity to ourselves, right? And maybe, to close family, right? But can you see that's where it stops? After that, we're miserly. And even if we give to causes, it's like it's after all my needs are taken care of, aren't they, for honor. So generosity is a bodhisattvic practice. Because a bodhisattva, they look at their body, they look at their intelligence, they look at their time, they look at their energy, they look at their financial resources, they look at everything they have, and their only thought is, how can I use this to benefit others? That's what it's all about. See, I thought it was all about me. All these things are for me. Can you see the difference? That's what I'm saying. This path, this bodhisattva path, is radical. But different. You know, you look at everything you have and you go, you know, how can I use this to benefit? So please reflect deeply on this path and this practice of, you know, again, like I said, the practice of giving and receiving, the exchange of Dong Len, is not just a little technique as it's been reduced to. It is a willingness to exchange even my own happiness, right, to make myself uncomfortable, to bring benefit to another. We know people do that all the time in this world, right? You look at these people, doctors without, you know what I mean? You know, they could have a cushy practice back, you know, medical practice, wherever they come from, right? Right? They have a really nice, cushy practice, but they're out there in some hellhole, right? Endangering their own well-being, you know. They're exchanging, can you see, that's what they're doing. They're exchanging their safety, their happiness, to benefit another. So please understand that this is not, you know, unknown to us. People do it. People who've never heard a word of Buddha Dharma do it. But that's what this is about. So again, not everybody can ready to run out and join the Doctors Without Borders, but you know, so many opportunities just in our ordinary life as we go through our day to, you know, everybody we encounter is our mother, is our child. So we care about them. And again, I've used the example before, but again, you know, you could have some complete stranger who you've been walked by every day, and all of a sudden, if something turns out, if somebody tells you, oh, that's your second cousin, actually, what happens? Next time you see them, you relate totally differently. Why is that? Same person. But somebody told you what? You're related. That's just an idea. But right away, you change to them. It's interesting. You know, people think, oh, you have to kind of do all this work. No. You know, the example that Shanti Deva goes with the horse, you know, everybody know that one. It's like, you know, those were the days with the Shanti Deva, Pacharumbashe. But anyhow, one of them, you know, it's like, you know, you're at the horse market, right? And this guy over here is a horse. He couldn't care less about it, right? Whether it's healthy, whether it's unhealthy, you know what I'm saying? Right? Just another horse. Go over, you look at it, check it out, do a little horse trading. Now it's yours. 1 minute after you bought it, all you're caring about is, how's my horse? Right? How's it, you know, does it need something to drink? You know, is it sick? You know what I mean? Right? Why? What's changed? Same horse. But now it's what? Mine. You know, Shanti Davis says, you know, just call everybody me. He says that. He said, it's just labeling. You know, the only reason we see the separation, we go, my body. But what if I called everybody else's body my body? See, that's just how we label things. It's through labels we enter the world of duality and separation. All motherly sentient beings, there's a reason they use those phrases. Because when you say it, and again, if your mother is somebody you care about, oh, this is a motherly, you know, this person waiting on me is a motherly sentient being. Might have been my, oh, this is like my child. That's all you have to do, and it changes instantaneously. Right? You don't have to do 15 years of Tong Len practice. So again, the practices we did last night, with absolute bodhicitta, nature of mind, resting awareness, practice we did then, exchanging self and others, willingness to bring the sufferings of other beings into ourselves and to give them everything good that we have is transforming. I hope you understand that. Now, the next, obviously, there are two things I want to know now. One is, are there any questions or confusions that anybody has about what has been presented at retreat before we leave? And then we'll just spend a few minutes talking about future practice. Yes. Right. These are the preliminaries, and they're not about self. The preliminaries are really just really about this world. You know, what's going on in this world? You know, it's like the forest, not the trees. So these are like, you know, it's like all of a sudden, you know, there's Nancy. Like, what's going on in this world? Why do I suffer? Why do people, like, oh, so you get impermanence. Oh, that's. You know, all this disappointment and frustration when things change. And this one, I thought I had it here, and then it changes into that. Oh, but there was something wrong. Oh, no, that's just the way it is. Inside, outside, atoms and everything. Cause and effect. Oh, it's not just, things aren't just happening. Things aren't just happening to me. It's cause and effect. And the other person, and me, and how we, right? So it's, again, defects of samsara. There's a reason that I've worked so hard to find happiness and meaning, like doing this and that, and even when I get it, it still doesn't work. You know what I mean? So it's like big picture. Okay? You know, when you get into things like absolute bodhicitta and relative bodhicitta and absolute, that you really get into self-distortions. Any other questions about any of the practice? Yes. Well, that's a way of establishing relationship. It's not, please understand, I know you have children, obviously, and we have parents. I mean, there's obviously kind of deeper karmic connections, right? You know, in terms of responsibility, right? Right? So Brandy has a special relationship with her children. She's not going to go home and say, you know, I'm really now going to carry Klee for all children. You guys are on your own. Okay? You know, so it's not right. It's so okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. So I appreciate, Maria saying, I can appreciate everything, but there's also, for at least for you and other people, there's a human element, and many things I'm scared of, and other things I really have a hard time with, certain kind of situations. I don't know if I'm ready to go into Ebola regions, and, right? Yeah, so I think, you know, it's interesting. Things like courage, talking really about courage. Courageous, you know, and actually, you know, another name for bodhisattvas is often the awakened warrior. Interesting, the awakened warrior. So courage is a big part of this. because it's the opposite of fear. Confidence is another, and I think that's part of it. So again, I would say the fact that you recognize in certain areas within yourself and in life a lack of courage or more fear, less courageousness, more, right? Not so confident of yourself is good. I mean, but again, I would say to everybody like that, please understand, it's not as if there's a courage switch. There's a confidence switch. Confidence and courage is something you develop. Right? And again, how do you develop it? By taking steps. By taking steps in that direction. Remember we talked about the miser. You know, again, you know, can he get something from his left hand to his right hand? Right? That's, you know, that's a beginning. At least there's some giving. You know, you're loosening that tightness. So again, I would certainly say, if you recognize that, you know, if your goal is, gee, I would like to be that courageous. I would like to be that confident, that I could deal it with all kinds of people and situations without fear or, you know, or strong sense of self holding back and wanting to protect. You know, again, I would, again, just sort of take that as a practice. Again, and it's a twofold practice. One is to always, as we've done here, is to look into that mind for that self that is giving you the message that it's too much for you. Is that really true? Or is that just a message you're getting from your historical Maria? It may not be true. You may be more courageous than you think. Remember the Cowardly Lion, the Wizard of Oz. You didn't read The Wizard of Oz in Austria. You know, the Cowardly Lion. The Cowardly Lion actually turned out to be pretty courageous. But he could never be courageous for himself, could he? But for his Dorothy and his friends, he found courage. So, again, you might say, gee, I'm just a fraidy cat. But, you know, if somebody, when your children were young, were threatening your children, you might be surprised by how brave you were. You see what I'm saying? It's kind of interesting. And you should kind of notice that. See? Well, no. You know, usually I'm just a wimp, but for some reason, you know, I was, right? And that shows you that it is there in you. Right? But for some reason, you tell yourself a story that it's not. But you see in circumstances, you know, you will be. I mean, it's always amazing to me. I see these little birds going after these big birds that are threatening their nests. And the big birds take off. I mean, they're kind of like, you know, I see them chasing these hawks around. I go, wow. Brave little bird. Why? It's protecting its young. So, again, I would definitely take steps to build courage and confidence. Right? And again, helpful in that is to more and more see that the messages of self may not be real messages. Okay, but also, again, to increase your concern and love for others as a motivator. Because again, if I said if your children were threatened, what would you do? And Maria would say what? Protect them. I mean, would you think about it? If your children were living on the street and all of a sudden, you know, somebody came up to harm them, would you just start running? Why not? Automatic, right. But what is the automatic pilot? Courage within you and a willingness at that moment not to think about yourself. Right? If you thought about yourself, you'd be running down the street, wouldn't you? But you're not thinking about yourself, you see? And that's, so that shows you in the world of selflessness, in the world of connection to others, there is courage. It's just there. Any other questions? We only have a short amount of time. Yes, and then we'll... Oh, yeah. Yes, definitely. Yeah. It's a yeah. So she's asking a very practical question. Tonglen is new to her. Before you take it mobile and you start, doing for everyone. Yeah. So you begin, just by bringing it into your meditation, right? And again, you'll see in the instructions there is like this is for meditation, this is post meditation. So first you could have, get it perfected in meditation. And again, you begin, like the miser, you begin, can you even just begin to work with your own self? Just like that. And perhaps can you begin to work with your future sufferings and work with them? And then maybe you work, family, friends. So you start out, do some light lifting first, which could be heavy. You know what I'm saying? So you start out like that, and sort of like we were saying with Maria, as your strength develops, you begin to move out. And it's to me, it's much better to see whether you can do it for yourself before you go, I'm going to do it for everybody. Yeah, I mean, just learning to work in this open, compassionate way with our own suffering, no longer turn away from it, no longer manipulate it, but be totally open. And use this transformative alchemy of Tonglen, to heal us every time it arises. Yes, and then yes. Yes. If that was your brother, if that was your brother, if that was your brother, if all of a sudden you saw this dirty person, right? And all of a sudden, let's say, as you got closer to them or they came up to you, you realize, oh, let's not go your brother. Let's say, oh, I used to work with him. He was a colleague. What would happen at that moment in your heart to that aversion? There's no me. Everything's just arising in awareness. Again, we can talk this way. In the deepest sense, everyone is me because everyone we perceive is arising in the same awareness that even the me arises. So in that sense, there is no separation. But from the practice point of view, can you see to say it's me may have meaning to you, but to get the heart going, the connection to say, oh, it's my child, it's my brother, can you see it just has a little more juice to it? And it's important that in our compassionate activity that there be juice. That's why, again, motherly sentient beings, my child, all beings are my children. I mean, it's. it's like in this world, that's probably as close as it gets to non-separation. Okay? Winter. Mm-hmm. Say that. All acts of compassion benefit someone but hurt someone else. Oh. So can you give me an example? Okay. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. 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 Maybe. I mean, that's a maybe. Right. So again, you know, and we can't get into it. That's another Dharma talk. But again, in Buddha, so the question is about that sometimes one can, seemingly act compassionately, such as on the property, there are all these baby ducklings, and as we've noticed, for those who've noticed over these days, their numbers are diminishing. And if you've been up at night, you've seen little raccoons, big raccoons running around here, you know where they're going. So you're saying, but, you know, by protecting the ducklings, if I make that choice, might I not be starving a raccoon? You know, okay. So wisdom and compassion. Okay, this is important. It's been a while. I used to rail about sentimentality at retreats with people, but that's what you're talking about. You know, compassion without wisdom and understanding, intelligence, is sentimentality. It's just the bleeding heart. But it has no clarity. It doesn't see clearly that in nature there is a kind of balance, right? And that when we act, there are consequences, right? And things aren't that simple, are they? Again, if you see statues of Avalokiteshvara, the Bodhisattva of compassion, you will see in his or her hand the eye of wisdom. It's very important. I mean, there's a reason it's there. It's not just sentimental, flowers and teddy bears. Oh, poor ducklings. I need to save them all. Ducklings live in their own duckling world and duck world. And natural world. And in that world, there are ducklings and there are predators. And predators, have you ever seen any little baby raccoons? They're quite cute too. Right? And when they're babies, you'll go, you find a little baby raccoon, you take it home, and feed it, and you want to take care of it, and it grows up, get big, you release it, it's right for the ducklings. I mean, again, this is the world. This is the truth of the world, isn't it? And either we control it, but as we know, we eliminated predators out west, and all of a sudden we find we have other problems. And so there is a balance in nature. Intelligence, wisdom will show us it. Now again, it doesn't mean if you're out there and you see some ducklings and you see a raccoon circling, I remember once being somewhere and I saw something just like that. I saw this mother bird and a baby bird, and I saw this cat creeping up to it. Then I picked up a rock and I threw it at the cat. I made a choice, didn't I? In that moment. Well, yeah, but again, let's just stop now just for time. But again, I would say, compassion, the capacity to both perceive and that there's suffering going on, empathy, and the desire and the action of relieving that suffering, there has to be some kind of intelligence operating. Or we can make it worse. There are many people in here who have thought they were acting compassionately and they only made the situation worse or blew up in your face, right? It showed, and often that's because there was no intelligence. We were just being sentimental. In Buddhist compassion is not sentimentality. It's just not the, you know, the, oh, poor, you know, so-and-so, right? And we know the classic one is an addiction, you know, oh, poor so-and-so, you know, they're going through such a hard time, they haven't had a drink all day. Wouldn't it be nice, you know, I should go out and, you know, get them some, right? Give them some money. That's not very compassionate, is it? Because it's not decreasing their suffering. It's only facilitating. So we need to take a break first so we have enough time so we can do our closing circle. Again, as I said to you, you're at retreat. You can do our closing circle. You'll be saying all kinds of wonderful things. And you've said them before. For those who've been on retreat, you know, doesn't mean that your intentions aren't good. But, you know, as Santi Deva said, there is bodhicitta of intention and bodhicitta of action. If you're having good intentions, that's good. But if they're not acted upon and brought into life, into the world of activity, they will just stay good intentions. So it is very important that you understand that what is awaiting you at home is a life that has not been on retreat with you. And if you want it to be different, you will have to be different. And you will have to be clear and conscious and diligent and vigilant, right, about how you want to proceed in this life. Now again, you know, take refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. Take refuge in your teacher. I mean, you know, Buddhism just doesn't abandon us, right? But historically, as known, you know, having teachers, having spiritual friends, having teachings, you know, having Sangha, having practice centers. These are all there to what? To support us, so we can follow through. Right? Because left to our own devices, and because most of us live in worlds and with people who aren't necessarily Dharma practitioners and enlightened beings, they may be very good people, right? But they don't get this. And that's just the way it is. So we have to understand that if there is something within us in our life that we want to change and transform, we need to make sure that we have the supports and the resources to make that happen. That's why we have community, and that's why we have teachings and intensives and retreats and days of mindfulness and, you know, websites, spiritual friends and mentors, you know, just here to, you know, to help us. So please, think of my 3-year-old grandson, whose mantra is, I can do it myself. He's only 3 years old. There's so much he can't do. But he thinks he wants to do it all himself. So somebody has to say to him, I think you need a little help. Right? So there's a 3-year-old in each one of us. You cannot do it by yourself. Oh, it's called the Great Path of Awakening. But again, actually, these days there must be a dozen books. I mean, but this is wonderful. But I think Longzhan is a very popular teaching, so there are many things. But this is a classic, great enlightened teacher commentary. So. Last dismissed.